Welcome to the Serotalk Podcast.
Serotalk Podcast.
Welcome to the Serotalk Podcast, your portal to the accessible digital lifestyle.
www.serotalk.com.
A production of Serotech Corporation, creators of System Access, the System Access Mobile Network, and SA2Go. Learn about new technology, cool software, useful websites, education, information, entertainment, user comments, and much more. And now, here's your host, Michael Loft.
Welcome to Serotalk.
Hi, this is Michael Loft. Welcome to Podcast 46 for July 19, 2010. Well, we're going to do some highlights from this year's ACB 2010 convention in Phoenix, Arizona. Now, some of these you may have heard on our 20 interviews that are already posted at serotalk.com, but I do have a few surprises, things that have not been posted just yet. One of which, for those of you into music and recording and multi-track and all that cool stuff, is an awesome program called Reaper. And we're going to speak with Derek Lane from North Carolina, who's going to give us an interesting demo of how one voice could be altered into a song that sounds so different from the original. Blood and glucose readings. Well, we've known about Prodigy, and they're talking about an upcoming talking insulin pump, but we're also going to find out about another device called the Solo V2 from a company called Biosense Medical Devices, so that there is more than one option out there for talking readings start to finish. So maybe no longer do we need sighted assistance, and now we even get prompts for the air code, so we know what those crazy things mean. We're also going to find out about Travel One. It's a company setting up cruises for blind and low vision persons. So if you've ever thought about taking a cruise and had some questions about how that works, I think this is a very interesting interview with Dave Krunk. Just a few other cool surprises, so listen in the next hour. I hope you'll like what you hear. And of course, for links to everything that we talk about, go to www.serotalk.com. So enjoy, my friends, and we'll be back in the studio on August 2nd, and I'm going to try to get some strips so that we can actually sample for you the new Biosense meter so you can hear it in action. So until we meet again, stay connected and stay directed. Hello, this is Michael Loft and Ricky Inger, and our special guest here at ACB 2010 convention in Phoenix. Derek Lane, how you doing, buddy?
I'm doing well. And yourself?
Very good. I'm going to pick your brain because you've been playing around with something that I want to expose our listeners to, and that being a program for doing multi-track editing of music and sound and so forth in Windows called Reaper. So we'll talk about that.
Sure. Reaper is a DAW. It stands for Digital Audio Workstation. And you may have heard of stuff like Sonar or Pro Tools or FL Studio. And then you may have saw the prices associated with those items and went, not so much. I don't think I'll go there. In the case of Pro Tools, which I think some people are going to be demoing now that it's accessible, you run into a $300 piece of software minimum and proprietary hardware that's associated with it. And, of course, you get to learn the Mac, which for some of you is not a problem, but for me is something I haven't really gotten into.
Yeah, you are right. I mean, I happen to have a mixer, a Mackionix 1220 that will work with it, but I've got to spend $249 for a special called M-Power version plus $50 for software from Mackie. So I've got a $300 investment, and I'm trying to decide which one I want to go with. But I'm curious about Reaper. I know most folks will be in the Windows space. We know it works with NVDA and WindowEyes, and yes, we've even contributed code from Serotech, from System Access, to help make it even more accessible.
Reaper is a beautiful program because it works, to me and what I do, just as well as Sonar and these other DAWs, and it is free for casual use, and I think only around 60 or 70 perhaps for non-commercial. And with Reaper, you have all your effects. You have your reverbs and your delays and all your EQs that you'd want and your compressors. And you have probably as many tracks as your hardware can handle. So if you want a choir of 40 of you, and you have nothing better to do on, say, any given Saturday than to make that happen, you could do it. Put reverb on the whole thing and not have to worry about going to a studio and tracking yourself that way.
Now, what about hardware? What kind of sound cards should we be bringing into this? A lot of people own the creative cards, and I've learned trying to do multi-tracking with them, the latency is kind of bad, and you get pops. And undesirable delays. What do you recommend for sound cards to go with Reaper?
I would say anything with ACO, because ACO is a way that Windows addresses audio, which is very rapid. You have very little latency.
Also, and even on the Creative, where they have the ACO option, ASIO, I think it is, right?
Yeah.
You would actually choose that. That would be the best thing for doing editing.
You could actually pull it off. There are, under Windows 7, you could even get away with the Realtek stuff if you were absolutely crunching on a budget, because any of the jacks on the back of the computer can be turned into line inputs. So you could bust out from a mixer, and I wouldn't recommend it because you run into balancing issues and stuff, but I mean, if you absolutely have to, you could pull it off. And even in the case where the delay is pretty bad, Reaper has options to compensate for that, so that when you record something and you're singing along with it or you're playing another instrument on top of it, the finished product are two things that are coherent and cohesive and that, you know, play at the same time.
So are there some initial modifications you have to make it work with speech?
There's a bridge called ReAccess, and I think the site for that is reaccess.com, I think they've managed to get. Check me on that. Is it com?
Yeah, I think it is. Well, we'll have a link to it as well at serotalk.com. All right, so you need this bridge. It's not a big deal, but you need to put a few files in place before you have the full accessibility of Reaper, right?
Because otherwise your track list won't read. And if your recording or a track is armed, it means it's ready to record. It won't. Your screen reader won't tell you that. And editing some parameters is kind of hard to do.
Okay, so
otherwise, and it gets a lot easier when you put ReAccess in the mix.
Okay,
but visually it doesn't interfere with Reaper, so that if somebody's looking at what you're doing, say helping you do some things that aren't quite accessible yet, it doesn't interfere with the workflow visually at all.
Okay, so you talked about arming. I guess there's a whole procedure that musicians are going to understand, maybe new people who make music but maybe haven't gone to the computer aspect of it. What's kind of the 1, 2, 3 or ABC of you install Reaper, you install this bridge, and then kind of how do you lay down your first tracks into it?
You tell it where your inputs and outputs are in the preferences dialog under the audio part of the tree view. Because it's not a tabbed interface, it's a tree view. It's kind of like the way the Miranda preferences are set up, if those of you are familiar with that program. It's very much like that. It's a tree view, and each section has its own options. And then you open that section, for example, audio, and under there you would have things like devices and playback and buffering and all these things that are usually fine as they're set by default. But the procedure, once you get, say, a Realtek or a Sound Blaster, or in more professional cases like M-Audio Delta or, one of the Fast Tracks or something picked, you would press F7 to arm the track, which means that it is ready to be recorded on. You'd press F8 if you wanted to monitor, in other words, hear what you're going to be recording in your headphones. And then you would press R to start recording, and that would be your first track.
Nice, and then you just bring in additional tracks if you want to layer them on top or layer them in a certain place, and you can go crazy with it based on your skills and interest or how simple or complex you want to get.
Yeah, and if you have no idea what to do, you hit F12. F12 is a training mode that essentially lets you press any number of keys, and it will tell you, as in your screen reader will tell you, what that key will do. From that, I found out that Alt up and down arrow adjusts the volume. Alt left and right adjust the pan of the track that you're pointing to. In other words, how much you hear it on the left versus the right. F brings up effects to put on the track. And so on and so on. The key list is huge.
Wow, F12 is the way to pull that. Awesome. Now, I'm not a musician per se. I do a little bit of production, but basically just interviews like this, and I just want to do basic cutting of undesirable segments. Is it pretty similar to SoundForge in that respect, or how is it different?
It's very similar to SoundForge, except the keystroke's different. It's Alt-Shift-Left bracket to start the selection that you want to cut, and then you move to where you want the selection to end, Control-Space to pause it, and then Alt-Shift-Right bracket, and then Delete, and it's dead. It's gone, and that's the end of that. So you've made your edit.
Oh, very nice.
You use the arrow keys. You scrub like you. Those of you who used to do editing with reels and a razor blade and a splicing block, you get some very familiar sounds that way. And that allows you to be more precise with where you make your edits.
And you have the go-to function where you can type in hour, minute, second, whatever.
The go-to dialogue, which is Control-J, is kind of neat in Reaper, because if you type a value such as 1:00:00, you'll go to 1 hour. 0 minutes and 0 seconds, that's the way that works.
Right.
But let's say you type in something like 28.1. That takes you to measure 28 beat one.
Oh, nice. Wow.
So if you're working with somebody on a music project and you're tracking them and they're like, that whole thing sucked from measure 28 to 32. You don't even have to fast forward. You can just go Control-J, type 28, make a selection from 28 to 32 on their vocal track, say. Select an option in the Reaper, one of the Reaper menus that allows you to change how the recording mode is set, and then will only selectively record within the bounds of your selection so that you don't accidentally erase any of the good material. And you can probably have all that done within a matter of seconds once you're familiar with the program.
Do you know the minimum computer spec that you have to bring into this?
I've ran it on my netbook.
Really?
Yeah. In fact, this morning I broadcasted with it from this exact location using my H4 as an interface and a software VST compressor to keep everything nice and in line so that no loud sounds would make anybody's ears bleed or anything like that. And it didn't cry about it at all. And I thought I'd have some timing issues, but there wasn't anything that anyone complained about, and the archive sounded pretty good. So you can squeeze it on any computer. Just results may vary when you start really getting crazy with effects and
multi-tracking, certainly on a netbook. But just the fact that it can record in that space and not lag, and that's pretty impressive, actually.
Yeah, because most netbooks, they don't really pull that off very well. Most things like that, if you run them on a netbook, you can tell very, very well that you're going to have some problems from the get-go. But Reaper seems to be the exception.
Any other important highlights you want to mention here before we'll turn and let you interview us?
Reaper has the amazing ability to manipulate audio musically. If, for example, let's say you're taking a Motown song or something and you want to sample it, or you want to put a beat behind it and kind of DJ with it or something.
Or maybe even change the key, right?
Or even change the key.
Right.
Okay, well, a couple problems you run into normally is, well, they didn't play to click. They just played the music. They played what felt right. They didn't have a steady 80 or 120 or whatever behind them. They just played the song. And it got recorded, and it got pressed to disc, and that was the end of that.
Kind of like We Are Family, you know, it's just a little bit off.
Yeah. It's just there. It feels good, but you can't really bring it into a DAW and sync it up on its own, because it would drift from everything else.
Right, just the rhythm's not right. The rhythm or the key, just
even if it started at 120, it may not end up that way. It may not stay there. One measure may be 118, and one might be 122. And these little tiny, tiny little drifts in time, which we wouldn't perceive just listening to the song and enjoying it for ourselves, will be really obvious when you have this reference click track that's going up against it. And as you see the reference drift farther and farther away, what you can do is stretch each measure or collapse each measure in time to fit any given tempo of your project.
Melody, melody, I love you. Melody, I love you. Melody, I really, really love you. Melody, I really, really, really love you. Melody, now I gotta go to bed now. 3, 2, 1, click.
I heard there's a lady on your mind.
Yeah.
When are you going to talk to her?
Tonight.
Well, tell us today in a few words what you're gonna say.
Okay, Melody, I really, really love you.
ForSarahTalk.com blog and podcast. It's the Quiet Ricky Anger. Are you awake over there? Did we put you to sleep?
I think she's asleep. Look at that.
She's snoring over there. Oh, my God.
Did
okay.
Say something?
Yeah.
Is everything good over here?
It's all good up in here.
All
righty. And Michael Love, thanks, Derek Lane, for joining me this afternoon to talk about Reaper. Check it out, all you musician types. Live at ACB 2010, I caught up with Chris Gray here. Curious, as a former president of the ACB and our ongoing efforts for advocacy, if anyone listening to the podcast, what should we be concerned about right now? What should we be really advocating? I mean, we've got all the new books and the EPUB format and all these protected, and maybe talking TV set-top boxes, but what should we be concerned and working on right now?
Well, I'll tell you, we're working very hard on the reading issue through the Reading Rights Coalition. Daniel Goldstein was here on Sunday, gave a very moving talk about the successes and the issues and difficulties in the online book arena. We've got to be watching that and vigilant about that every moment. We're doing well. We're making progress with our friends over at Amazon with the Kindle. Now we have to get to work and begin beating on Sony, because they've got a long ways to go, my friend. And so that's one kind of issue. I believe that, I'm speaking about this from my own perspective as a person who works in the field of medical technology, we have got to get the National Institutes of Health and the government more invested in creating accessible health products for blind people. There's a lot of stuff out there that can help people stay well, if they're older, to stay in their homes and stay well, and blind people can't use it at all. So that's a focus of mine. I work on that all the time. We had our great success with the currency litigation. Now we've got to succeed in getting accessible currency. So we're working hard at that. The Treasury is here this week, and I think that's important. I think those are some of the real key issues that I'm focusing on right now.
Now, what about the HR 3101 and what's it, SB 3304? Is that, are those the
yes.
right numbers? What are we hoping to accomplish with those? And I understand there have already been a few setbacks. It's certainly, of course, it hasn't even gone to the full House or Senate yet, has it? So these are still in committee? Or what's going on? Or what do we hope to see out of these bits of legislation?
HR 3101 and the companion Senate bill, they have a little bit different language, and the language overall in 3101 is slightly better. But of course, we support them both. The idea of these laws are to increase the power of and significantly expand the Section 255 of the Telecommunications Act, which was passed many years ago. And while it was a great hope at the time, it has not functioned very well for blind and visually impaired people. 3101 calls upon and takes to task the companies who are building inaccessible cell phones, inaccessible set-top boxes, inaccessible communications devices that we can't use. The longer we can't use these, the longer we fall behind the curve, the further we fall behind the curve in terms of our ability to compete with our sighted friends and our peers. Not being able to use a set-top box may be viewed as a little bit ephemeral, a little bit like a nice thing to have. It really isn't. It causes issues for all of us in terms of our ability to learn. And these boxes don't just work on your entertainment TV. They work in audiovisual equipment and so forth. It's all very important. We have had some setbacks. All the language that would have helped deafblind people in this bill has been removed. And we're going to try and get it back. If there was ever a population that is being left behind in telecommunications, it's people who are both deaf and blind. To remove a $10 million provision, $10 million is a lot to you and me, but it's worth about half a cent in congressional terms, and there are sources where the money can come from that already exists. It isn't new money. It's just allowing money that's already there to be spent for a population that can't always afford this stuff by themselves. We're going to try and get that put back in. There are some issues with the audio description language in there of only allowing it for the largest markets and not allowing it for mid to small markets that would make that concrete and fixed for many, many years to come until we basically pass another bill. We want to get that fixed. But 3101 is a fantastic step forward. It is moving. There's a very, very good chance it will pass the House and the Senate in 2010. And I'm very excited about the potential that it holds.
So you meant, just two quick questions. You mentioned hardware, so my concern there is you have a company like Google actually creating the Android operating system,
right,
and passing the buck and saying, well, we just build the OS. It's up to the hardware manufacturers what they enable. Is that addressed, or is software companies and their accessibility addressed as well?
We believe it is. I think the provisions are a little stronger for hardware providing companies, but both software and hardware issues are addressed in the legislation, at least right now, and I think that there are going to be great levers in there that we can use to convince the people creating operating systems to do their part too, because they have to. If they don't, we're all still paddling up the same creek, so to speak.
So I guess my concern, you've got Gary Shapiro from the Consumer Electronics Association saying, well, this stuff's already out there. People just need to shop around and find a product, be it the iPhone or some kind of talking remote control. But then also I'm concerned if you have 2,000 electronics manufacturers involved and with many congressmen who can be bought for $5,000 to $10,000 a vote, I'm just really concerned what we're going to have at the end of the day.
You never know with legislation, and I wish I could put your mind at ease about that, but my mind isn't at ease about that either. And you know, the sad thing is, I've had some extensive communications with Gary Shapiro, and he says whatever is convenient to say at the moment to try and win an argument which basically says blind people don't need this technology and we need to pull back on regulations that throttle innovation in the business sector. It's all a lot of self-serving rhetoric. What he says is not true for the most part. This will not stifle innovation. It simply allows a population who has been cast aside and not allowed to be a part of innovation to be players at the beginning of the game instead of 10 to 20 years down the road after the game gets started.
Yours is 96.
Yeah, and then we're trying to retrofit, which doesn't happen.
Yeah.
So,
and you know, retrofitting is always more expensive, more complicated, and never as effective. Never.
Have we, I guess if this bill, the bills fail, will we be looking at maybe creating some kind of focus group or something and working and at least going to the manufacturers and saying, well, while you don't have to, here's a significant market of people and here's some guidelines, some things to follow. Has that been looked at or on the table for consideration to at least get those that are interested that can look at Apple and say, hey, we included accessibility and we made a few million as a result?
Well, I never want to say that sitting down at the table and negotiating is not in consideration. And in fact, when the iPhone came out, ACB went to Apple and just raised a huge fuss about it. We had countless meetings with Mike Shabanek at Apple and other people at Apple, and we always believe in sitting down at the table. The problem is, in the case of Apple, we got a tremendously positive response. And I'm sure it wasn't just us. I'm sure it was other factors, other things pushing Apple at the same time. I'd like to think we did some good in that area, and I believe we really did. But in most cases, you sit down at the table with these guys, and you get up, and you leave, and you haven't gotten anywhere.
Exactly. It's a lot of lip service, like you're saying. They right. tell you what you want to hear, and then go tell their partners what they want right. to hear. And
to answer your question more specifically, we're really not considering what we might or might not do if the bills don't pass. Our focus right now is on getting them passed.
Passed with minimum
modifications. They may go to conference. They may not. There may be new amendments. We have no way of knowing for sure. But, you know, here's the deal. We had a bill like 3101 in the last Congress. We didn't get anywhere with it far enough to even have a hope of it being passed. This time we've got a lot of traction. We may well get it passed. If we don't, we'll go back and try again. Legislation is a long-term proposition, and you start at one place and wind up at the next place. We don't tend to give up on these issues.
Well, you can. I mean, it requires a lot of persistence. And then even when you get the legislation passed, then you get the courts involved.
Yeah, that's right.
So I just want people to understand that there's people who dedicate their lives to working on very complex issues for accessibility that many of us just may take for granted. And that's why I want to commend you and the work that you've done, and many people like yourself will do that. And those of us in the grassroots effort to sometimes just email or contact the company and maybe get a developer of an iPhone app to fix it and go, wow, I didn't know it was that easy. And
we could not do this without you. The grassroots are what drives this effort. They really are.
Very good. Thanks a lot, Chris Gray, for your time. He's at Bay Area Digital Booth 25, and you can check it out here. I'm live at ACB 2010. This is Michael Loft for the Sarotalk.com blog and podcast. Live at ACB 2010, this is Michael Off, and I am at APH here. They have three tables, 58 through 60, and I've caught up with Michael McCarty, the busiest blogger I've ever met. The Fred Said blog, he's overseeing that, and a wealth of other duties at APH. How are you doing today, sir?
I am doing well.
Well, very good. Nice to meet you in person.
Yeah, absolutely. I see you on the net all the time, too. So.
That's right, and we retweet each other's wares. So if you're not following Fred Said, it's a great resource of blindness-specific news and information. How do you stay up on all the blindness-specific news that you post?
Well, my actual title at APH when I first started was Fred's Head Coordinator, and so that's when we had the original Fred's Head database. It was out for a couple years. Whenever I was hired, they wanted somebody there full-time that would update the records, keep everything up to date, make sure that, you know, the addresses and everything we had listed were correct for the various companies. And eventually we discovered that a blog would allow us to reach a bigger audience and allow Google to index our files and all that sort of thing. So eventually we switched over from the database to the blog, and that got to be so popular, and then Twitter was kind of getting on the scene, and so we started a Fred's Head Twitter feed. So they decided that Fred's Head Coordinator didn't seem to be a title that was going to be engrossing enough, so they switched it now, and they call me a Social Media Coordinator. So now I do the blog, the Twitter page, and the Facebook page that we're getting ready to launch here before too long.
Well, social media is very important, and companies who master that benefit both monetarily and socially. I mean, they communicate with their audience and their potential customers and so forth. So, and you, APH, is really kind of leading the way as far as AAT vendors, in my opinion, as far as using social networking, not only to promote your own wares, but to just really let people know of options and articles of interest and kind of mainstream coverage of blindness issues as well.
Yeah, I've had people ask me, you know, before they say, well, if you're an APH, you know, sponsored thing, why are you posting so much stuff about other people's technology and other people's gadgets? And what I say to that is social media, I mean, to understand social media, you got to be social. You know, APH, we understand that we don't make every product out there that's blindness related. We don't want to do that. What we do want to do is if something's out there that somebody needs, a teacher in a classroom needs a project, We'll make it. But we understand that there's other ways to do things. So, you know, if there's kitchen gadgets out there, we're not really into the kitchen gadget scene. So we want that to be a resource. We want somebody to know that those type of gadgets are out there. And that's really what Fred's Head was designed to do, was to tell people, this is all the stuff that's out there that's related to blindness. We make some of it, but there's a lot of other great companies that make other pieces of it. And so that's kind of what the blog does. That's what the Twitter site really does. And the Twitter site also gives us the ability to kind of celebrate blindness as far as, like, here's a blind athlete that, you know, just won a marathon last week. So we'll tweet that story.
Or two blind politicians running for government in Australia.
Exactly. And so that's the kind of thing that we wouldn't... On the blog, we try not to get into things that are time-sensitive. Because really, when you start doing that, you got to maintain it. You put an article in, you got to delete it a couple weeks later. You know, you can spend all your days just doing that. So the Twitter site really lets us put in things that are time sensitive. So if there's something coming up, like we have this bill HR 3101 that's going through, and we're hoping that's going to get passed and all that to give us greater access, we can post things about that as they happen in the Twitter site.
Yeah, that's interesting developments, because with 2,000 manufacturers, you know, they're going to be lobbying maybe to have certain elements of it repealed. And I understand there was something modified having to do with DVS now, where it's only the top 25 markets, which
right.
would not include Louisville or Evansville, where I reside, and probably where most of our users reside. So it's kind of interesting to follow along with that and see where it goes. And there is a related Senate bill, is there not?
Yes,
so
there is.
You've got two different factions, and it'll be curious to see how all of that plays out.
And that's the kind of stuff we can talk about on the Twitter thing, too. And, you know, that way people that are interested in that can follow that. Well, the blog is going to give you more of our tips and techniques on how to do things if you're blind or visually impaired. So if you want to know how a blind person would, I don't know, sweep the floor, or how a blind person might sew something, that's the kind of stuff you're going to find in the Fred's Head blog, along with some technical articles on how to do things on the computer, websites that you could visit that are going to be accessible. That's the kind of stuff that we put in the blog.
Well, you're doing a great job. A lot of stuff. I have to pick and choose what I read, because you come up with so much stuff.
Oh, yeah. There's a ton of stuff.
And that's the whole art, is information overload. So you have to focus on, you know, what's important to each person. But you're doing a great job. I would encourage everyone to follow Fred's Head, or twitter.com/Fred's Head. And I don't think you'll be disappointed. A lot of good stuff there. I'm always looking for news resources, and you've got a great one there.
We always try to post, you know, things that are going to be relevant. I had talked to a girl today. She said, I loved following Fred's Head. There's just so much information out there. She said, I didn't realize that there was that much stuff going on with blindness. And to me, that's really the cool thing. There is a lot going on with blindness. Just ton loads of technology, stuff from other countries. And it is kind of neat to see, you know, how is blindness... What does that mean to people in other countries? You know, things that we don't really think about. What people in India, you know, what are they going through? What are the blind and visually impaired folks there face every day? And so it's really kind of cool to see those kind of posts.
Definitely. Well, check it out, if you will, folks, and come by the booth here if you're at the convention, or check it out. What's aph.org?
Yep.
Is that right?
That's it. And you can come to our new shopping website, which is shop.aph.org. That'll put you right into our shopping area where you can look at all of our products and see what you like. You like it?
I do. Very good. And for us old fogies who still use Braille paper, there you go. You guys got it hooked up.
Still got it. Absolutely.
All right, very good.
Tons of it.
Thanks a lot, Michael McCarty from APH American Printing House in Louisville, Kentucky. And they even, if you're looking for work, I even saw they posted a phone number with a job line. So if you maybe don't mind relocating to the great city of Louisville, Kentucky, there might even be work for you if you have the right skill set. So check it out. Live at ACB 2010 for Cerotalk.com. This is Michael Loff. Live at ACB 2010, this is Michael Loff, and I caught up with the Jeremy Rose here. He's a booth right next door to us here in number 26. BioSense Medical Devices here, right?
Yes.
And what are you offering?
We have currently released the Solo V2 fully audible blood glucose monitor. It has more audible commands than any other monitor currently in the market, and is fully accessible.
Fully audible, wow. So explain what it does. You're saying there are others that
have partial accessibility, but you're the only one bringing everything to the table here.
Yes, there's a difference between what is referred to as talking meters and what we have as a fully audible meter. A lot of the talking meters only give you the audible results, whereas in the fully audible monitor, the Solo V2, from the setup all the way through the process of setting it up, testing your blood and retrieving your data, every facet and function of the monitor is audible.
Wow, so what kind of things can we do here?
Well, I think the most important thing about it is it is accessible, and you can test and set up unassisted with the monitor, so it promotes independence and safety as well. A lot of monitors will give you an E3, E4 error, you know, if there's an error during the process. However, that doesn't do you a lot of good if you don't know what the error is. It audibly explains any error messages so that there's no confusion through the process, as well as prevents low blood readings. If you don't get enough blood on the strip, a lot of monitors will just give you a low reading, which we all know is very dangerous. However, the Solo V2 will prompt you to and alert you saying, insufficient blood, please test again.
Now I understand you have some ability to back up your results to a computer for storage and maybe comparisons, or so you can monitor your levels over, you know, a period of time. Is that correct?
Yes. We have, again, fully accessible download software that is free on our website. It takes just a few minutes to download. It automatically put it on your desktop. And we offer a standard USB cable that you hook your monitor up to to your computer and download all your results, which is also offered at no cost because we understand how important it is to monitor your results, which it holds 500 results. When you get to that, you download all of them or however often, and we're the only fully audible monitor that has accessible and working download software.
Well, so how much is the device, V2?
We work a lot with DMEs, mail order DMEs, and mail order pharmacies. If you're insured with private insurance or have Medicare or any kind of Medicaid, it's typically no cost to the patient. However, we understand that there are cash-paying patients that have to obtain the monitor, and we have companies like Bay Area Digital, Independent Living Aids, and MaxiAids that offer the monitor, and they typically retail those around anywhere from $65 to $75.
Very good. So competitive with any other devices, but much more functional from what you're saying.
Without question, yes.
So you don't sell them directly here, go through one of these third-party entities, you're more of a direct mailing entity, or someone can come by your booth here at 26 and get one of these if they hear this before they leave the convention?
Without question, they can come by the booth. I'll be more than happy to take care of them with a monitor. You know, if they're an insurance patient, they get the monitor, they can get and get coverage. I'll be more than happy to give them a monitor at booth 26. If they'd like to pay for one in their cash paying situations, you know, Bay Area, like I said, Bay Area Digital is right next to me in booth 25, so that's convenient.
Well, very good. What is the website where folks can go and learn more information about this device?
Okay, we're out of Atlanta, Georgia. Our website is www.solometers.com. It's fully accessible with any screen readers, so you can maneuver through the website without any troubles. And you can fill out a form on there to register your meter, get a free skin, and go on with some of the moderators. We have a Solo community on there where you can get updates from other individuals in the community that are sharing their stories.
Any other products or anything you're working on in the future that you can talk about at this time?
Well, we have some other stuff that we're working on, but I'm not at liberty to discuss those at this time.
Oh, yeah, the mighty NDA. We understand. I live with those myself.
Yes,
so.
Sir.
Very good. Jeremy Rose with BioSense. Please check this out if you are in need of a device to monitor your readings and make sure that you stay healthy. Live from ACB 2010, this is Michael Law for Serotalk.
Thanks.
Live at ACB 2010, this is Michael Off, and I caught up with Jerry Munden here, and this is a Prodigy meter. So let's talk about what you're doing, some great tools for diabetics, and you're also, I guess, working on a talking insulin pump. And it's funny because that conversation had just come up just a few days ago of the need for that.
Yes, it is, Michael. We are working on a lot of new products. We have our voice meter that's won the Access Plus Award from the NFB and the AFB, worked with a lot of different major blind organizations such as the ASB and a bunch of them to put the features on there that make it totally accessible for folks with diabetes.
So describe how this works, what you can do with it, and how much we're talking about.
Okay. The Prodigy Voice Meter, again, the design of it, one of the people that helped us put that together and design the features was Lynn Bailiff, who is herself a blind certified diabetes educator and a host of other folks. But it enables a person to do the complete setup and do the entire test without assistance from a sighted person.
Wow, yeah, that's very important. And so you get the strips and go through the whole motion here. I'm trying to understand someone coming in who maybe is new to diabetes and understanding kind of the 1-2-3 process of setting up this machine.
Well, first thing, if you just got your new meter, the voice, you would go through the setup mode, and that would enable you to go and set the time, the date, the volume that you want the voice to play back to you at, and all the setup features. And then when it's done, you would turn the meter off, and then you would be ready to do a test. To do a test, if the meter's off, you would simply insert the test strip, and it takes about 3 seconds. It says apply blood now, and it draws in a 7-milliliter small sample of blood and starts a 6-second test cycle, and then it will read your test result to you.
Very good. And how much is this Prodigy meter?
Generally, to buy it for cash, it sells in the ballpark of around $75.
Wow, $75. That's much more reasonable than other products out there. And then what about the insulin strips? You sell those as well, or they go to a third party to acquire those?
Primarily, we're selling right now through third parties, Michael. And it depends on where you buy the strips. Some people sell them 50 strips for under $20. So they're out there. We make American-made products. I'm diabetic for 37 years. Our president's diabetic. We try and make quality products and make them affordable as well.
Very good. So let's talk about what you have in development. So you have a talking insulin pump. I assume that's going to cost a little more. That's a little more detailed device. But what are you looking for release on that?
The talking insulin pump, there's been a lot of people asking for a talking insulin pump for literally years. And again, we've been one company that listens to the needs of the vision impaired blind diabetics and take action. We are working very quickly. We're finishing up some working models now. We'll go through the usability studies, and we anticipate having that available for sale by the first quarter of next year.
Well, very good. Q1 of 2011. Do you know what price it may be, or is that still to be decided? Or
The price is to be decided, but our plan is to sell it considerably less than what the major pumps are selling for now. The same we do with our strips. We're able to make them and sell them for less, and we plan to make a very high-quality, accurate pump and sell it for less than what is standard in the industry.
Well, very good. Why don't you give the website and phone number so folks can contact you for more information?
Sure, I'd love to do that. Our website is www.prodigymeter.com, and our phone number is 704-285-6400.
All right, very good. Thanks for taking a few minutes. And you are here, I believe, booth 15 of those here this while they're still at the convention. Come on by and check it out, or check out the website live at ACB 2010. For Cerro Talk, this is Michael Loff.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you. Live at ACB 2010, this is Michael Loff. And I caught up with Vicki Collins here with the National Library Service. A very popular topic among all of our listeners. And Vicki, would you tell us here kind of what's new to NLS, or what are you showing here at your booth 28 at the ACB convention?
Yes, Michael. Probably what we're most excited about is our new digital player. We have both a standard and an advanced player, and it's a digital player that is going out to all of the network libraries throughout the United States and is being distributed on a sort of first-come, first-served basis. And we hope that within the next year or so, everybody in the entire network will have a digital player. We're also, of course, distributing digital books. And we're very excited about our BARD program, which is the Digital Talking Book and Magazine Download Program. And in that program, you can sign up for the Braille and audio reading download, and you can actually get books 24/7 by downloading them to your computer. We have almost 20,000 books available on BARD, and more are being added every week. And of course, many of your listeners will be familiar with Web Braille, which will eventually be added to the BARD program, but right now is a separate program and has just celebrated its 10th anniversary. So Web Braille has been around for 10 years now.
So how do you determine which books are going to be added? In other words, are you using the data based on what things people are currently downloading to kind of use for trends?
Well, there are a number of things that we do. We do have a National Collection Development Committee, and that meets annually to make recommendations to our collection development group so that we can choose the 2,000 titles that are most wanted by our readers. Naturally, we try to balance our collection, and we aren't able to have all of the various things that each one of us would like to read, but we try to have something for everyone, particularly the kinds of things that you would find in a small public library.
Well, that sounds very exciting. Now, I noticed you've entered some agreements, and some of your books come from third party. For example, there's books I bought at Audible and then found them with the same narrators show up on NLS. So how is that working?
Well, I'm not exactly familiar with that. I would say that we are purchasing some commercially available titles as a way to expand our collection. It's still a fairly small number of titles. Generally, we try to make an effort to not do those things that are being done and readily available in other media.
Well, that would make sense, right, if it's already being covered by some other entity. So I notice you've set up a new system where things used to kind of come in every Monday through Friday, but now every Friday is kind of book day, right? That's when all your new titles and everything is made available?
Right, and BARD Friday so far is a big day, but eventually we'll be doing it maybe even every day.
Oh, that's very exciting stuff. Now, what can people, I know some people want the advanced player, and maybe talk about the differences so people can determine if the basic player will meet their needs, or who should actually be asking for one of the advanced units.
Okay, we think that many people will find that the standard unit will meet all of their needs. The exciting thing about the player is that it will remember where you left off, but it does have a lot of features in both the standard and the advanced. Both of them, of course, have the sleep button, which many people enjoy. The advanced player is one that would really be needed by people who are reading a lot of nonfiction books, a lot of cookbooks, or even books that need to be navigated in more detail. So otherwise, if you're reading a book and you just like to start at the beginning and read it through, if it's a mystery, if it's a romance, if it's a Western, those are ones that are primarily going to be fine with the standard player.
Now, originally I heard 2014, but you're saying you hope to get everyone fitted within the next year, so either production has gone faster or you're really honed in on which people, or how does that work? Or did they start making more advanced players? Because I know there initially was an issue of there were more of the standard players made than the advanced. How did they, was there any adjustments made there?
Well, at the moment, we are still doing 80-20, but there is a possibility that we could change that percentage. We are doing about 20,000 players per month, so that's getting them out into the field, and we are hopeful that by the end of 2011, everybody who wants a player will have one.
Okay, I want to ask you a tech question. If you don't know, I will respect that because it is kind of a geeky question, but some of us like to play around with the unit, and I know it has the ability in the advanced one, you create this folder called Audio Plus Podcast, and we can play MP3s and play our podcasts and things on. Are there any other planned upgrades that you know of to the firmware of the players?
Well, I guess I would say that our engineers are working all the time to try to improve the player, so that we're always looking forward to what the next advance will be.
Well, that sounds pretty good. Now, are those distributed?
Michael, one I will mention, of course, is the bookshelf feature, and that's a feature in which you can download multiple books and then have multiple books on a cartridge. So the bookshelf feature is a new feature since the player came out.
Okay, yeah, that's very useful. There's a few enhancements, I think, people who add other external materials to help them kind of sort, because right now they all kind of show up in one big book, but we've been very impressed. I have to give NLS and the whole BARD program really kudos. You've done an excellent job. You made it as easy to use as technically possible while protecting the content, which we know you have to do to satisfy the publishers. So are there any plans to have any other formats? And the reason I ask that, this EPUB is becoming a very popular format. Of course, you don't have any kind of text to speech capabilities, but are you looking at anything beyond just the standard way that books are narrated now, or is it pretty much business as usual?
Well, I guess I'd have to say, Michael, I'm not a geek, so I'm not sure that I could really answer that question, but certainly if we have questions like that coming in, we would like to know about it.
Is there a place where people can actually request titles so that the annual, you know, review that they might actually consider them? Can people make requests?
We always encourage everyone to go to their network library, whatever their state library for the blind and physically handicapped is. That's where you want to make your recommendations.
Right, and hope they forward that information. Okay, Vicki Collins here with the NLS and the BARD program, doing an excellent job. Thank you very much for taking a few minutes. Give this starting point website if people want to get signed up. Maybe they haven't done so yet, haven't dived into the BARD program.
Well, with BARD, we are now in a transition so that actually the local libraries are, in many states, are already doing BARD. So I would recommend that you check with your local library for the blind in your state and see what the best way to sign up for BARD is right now.
Okay, fair enough. So you can't do anything until you register with your local network cooperating library, I believe they're called. So great. Thanks a lot, Vicki. For Sarotalk.com, this is Michael Loff. Live at ACB 2010, this is Michael Loff, and I caught up with Dave Krunk here. He's with a company called Travel One, and he's here a part of the ACB store, which is in booths number 3 and 4. And Dave schedules 1 to 2 trips per year, specifically with the blind in mind.
That is correct.
So what kind of vacations or travel itineraries have you lined up here, Dave?
Well, so far what we got lined up that's coming up is October this year. October 17th through the 24th is on the Carnival Splendor out of Los Angeles, doing the Mexican Riviera to Puerto Vallarta, Mazatlan, and Cabo San Lucas. And then we actually set up a Panama Canal cruise for next year, May 7th through the 15th, out of Fort Lauderdale to go to Panama, Colón, Panama, Costa Rica, and then also Cozumel, Mexico. So those are a couple trips that we've got planned up right now that are coming up soon.
Okay, so what are we talking about in terms of price here for someone who wish to pursue either of these?
Okay, for instance, the one coming up in October on the Mexican Riviera, that price will start off at $835 per person based on double occupancy, but that includes the cruise, port charges, taxes, and gratuities, and of course all your meals and entertainment's already all included in that price. The one for May for going to the Panama Canal, that price starts off at $1,067 for a 7-day cruise. And again, that's per person based on double. That includes the cruise, all taxes, your prepaid gratuities, and of course all your meals to entertainment on board the ship. Now, what we do that's different, though, is that these trips are escorted by myself and my staff. But also, the menus, I personally put the menus in Braille and large print. Make sure that your cabin number and everything's in Braille or large print. When we get off the ship, myself and my staff is escorting the trip itself as far as the tour. So say we're going to do a tour with the that's coming up in October. One of the tours that we're doing is going to be swimming with the dolphins. So you're escorting. We're going with them to do the dolphin tour. That's escorted by us. and everything is being totally described. We're there as like a safety net to make sure everything goes great and you guys have an excellent vacation.
So I don't know how large of a staff you have. Do you set some limit on the number of people that you schedule any one tour?
I have, as far as people going on the trip, no. The lowest we've had is about 30 people. So far, the most I've had in the future has been about 130, 140. So no, there's no limit because I set the staff 1 for 10.
Okay, so it's a 10-to-1 ratio.
That is correct.
Of course, people traveling in a group, certainly that helps.
Yes, it does.
Now, what do we need to know about passports either getting in or leaving or going into other countries or getting even back into the States? Is that an issue or what do you do there?
Not on these particular cruises. That is not an issue. And the reason why is they have a passport law, but for cruises, since it's considered a circle cruise, we're starting in Los Angeles and ending in Los Angeles, all you need is a birth certificate that is state issued and then your photo ID. Now, if we were taking a cruise that would, say, start in Los Angeles and end in Vancouver, then you've got to have a passport because it's ending in Vancouver and you've got to fly out of Vancouver. So that's where the passport comes into effect.
Okay, so let's say we spend $10.67 to book one of these cruises. Then what do we need to keep in mind as far as tips and gratuities and other costs that we might have along the way?
Well, on that price includes your tips and gratuities for the staff on board the ship. But what is going to be an additional cost would be a tour that you may sign up, say you wanted to swim with the dolphins or the stingrays or something, or your bar tab, such as soda or any alcoholic beverages. That would be an additional cost. And, of course, your airfare to get to that particular port. Say you lived in Phoenix, Arizona, well, you need to fly to Fort Lauderdale. That price is not included in that cost.
Okay, and then how are the prices, say, for soda or alcohol? Is it comparable to something like in a hotel or a regular bar, or how much people should allocate for that?
It is comparable as far as like if you're staying at a hotel. Some of the prices could be a little higher depending if you get what we call their foo-foo drinks that's in their souvenir glasses. Then you're probably talking $6 to the glass or something like that. But most of the alcoholic drinks would run anywhere from around $2.75 or so, maybe $3.40, something like that. Now, as far as a soda, you're looking at about $1.50 for a soda. But as far as a soda, if you're a soda drinker, you can purchase a soda card on the cruise, which is around $40 to $45, and that gives you unlimited soda beverages. So all you do is just show your card, and boom, you get a soda. So if you're a really big soda drinker, that's the best thing to do.
Okay, and so what kind of entertainment? Do they have different bands and things that travel along on the ship to play in the evenings, or what kind of evening entertainment do we find?
They have all kinds of in the evening, as far as entertainment goes, they will have, they've got disco going on. They'll have a country bar. They'll have the blues going on. They have a piano bar, which is like a sing-along type deal. As far as the main show would be anywhere from a Las Vegas-style show to a comedy show. Sometimes they'll have a magic show going on, which, of course, you know, with those that are totally blind, really doesn't help as much. But those that are low vision or have some vision, we get the first three rows of the main showroom, so that way they're able to somewhat maybe see the show as far as a bit better. But, they have all kinds of entertainment going on for pretty much anyone that's wanting a certain type of entertainment that's going on. Of course, they also have the casinos on board, so those that like to gamble, they've got the casinos. Some of the activities throughout the day, they've got the swimming pools that are open. They'll have bingo that's going on, which I provide Braille and large print bingo cards for those that like to play bingo, so they're able to get involved with that. And then sometimes we'll do our own activities. For instance, if we've got like 3 days at sea or something like that, I may have one or two as far as our own movies that are audio described. So I'll purchase that movie and we'll have our own movie theater with popcorn and things going on. So
you can reserve an area and then your participants can kind of congregate.
That is correct. So we can do our own thing. Sometimes we've actually had our own activities as far as arts and crafts and things. So it's worked out very well for us. I've been doing this for about 9 years. I've done about 15 cruises in the past with a lot of people from all over the United States that have traveled with me that have done very good.
So the food usually pretty good? Is it buffets? Do they have certain meals on certain type days of the week? Or how does that work?
They have food 24 hours a day. You've got a 24-hour pizzeria on board. You have a 24-hour ice cream bar. They'll have the buffets. If you wanted a buffet, you can go to the buffet. As far as breakfast, lunch, and dinner, you've got the main restaurants that you can go sit down and have dinner at and have breakfast at and be waited on. If you go to the buffet, what's good is that the staff with the cruise line will assist you going through the buffet and sitting you down. And that, so as far as a person, if a person said they didn't get enough to eat, it's their own fault. And as far as the food is excellent. It's very good.
Well, sounds like a nice getaway, and I guess bring your swimwear, certainly, if you want to take advantage of the pools and everything, or, you know, do some sunbathing on the decks or what have you.
Well, like I said, they've got anywhere from 2 to 3 swimming pools. They have the hot tubs. They've got a spa. So, you know, say that you want to get a massage or a facial or a pedicure, whatever, they've got that on board. They have a gym that you can go to for those that work out. They have all the latest equipment as far as the Nautilus equipment that they have and everything. So it's a great way for a vacation. On a cruise, Mike, you can do as much as you want, or you can just go there and sit and relax and let all the worries go away.
Best of both worlds. I want to ask you how things may have changed in the last 9 years. I know initially there were issues with accessibility, especially with certain cruise ships or cruise lines, and also I understand there's been some bill recently passed to improve accessibility. So what are some issues there? How has that changed in the last 9 years?
It has changed quite a bit. I mean, from the moment I started till now on what I've done, some cruise lines, it's still a little hard to work with. I work with any cruise line, but the one that I found that has been fantastic for me to work with has been Carnival Cruise Line.
And Carnival was one I know in the late 90s that was under the most heat. So they've done an about face, and I guess they found it's really been beneficial to look at us as a market of people that will come and use their services once they make it accessible, and that's good.
They really have. They are the only cruise line that I know personally that trains their staff to work with visually impaired people as far as clients go. Before we get on board a ship, their entire staff goes through a class to redo their class on how to work with those that are visually impaired. But then we're also then treated as VIPs. I mean, I have not been... We've had the most excellent service that you can ever get from a cruise line, by the way they've taken care of us. Also, those that want to bring their service animals are more than welcome.
That was my next question. Yeah. How does that work? How does...
That works out great because they set up an area, a relief area for the service animals. If you have a balcony cabin, they put a relief area on your balcony so you've got your own private bathroom for your dog, for your service animal. If not, then we set it up like either on deck 3 or 4. Again, I personally make sure that the menus are done in Braille and also large print because I do those myself. The cruise line sends me the information and then I do it. Your last name is in Braille and large print along with your cabin number on your cabin door. That's something that I go ahead and do. But like I said, Carnival and them have come a long way as far as really working with us because they see that, you know what, they want to travel just like everybody else and they want to be able to enjoy their vacation. And that's what's been really good about it.
So pretty much all the ones you do are through Carnival because of their cooperation to make it as great an experience as possible.
I have done NCL, Royal Caribbean, and Costa in the past. Okay, so I have worked with other cruise lines, but the one that I have found that been the best to work with has been Carnival Cruise Line.
Well, very good. Why don't you give some contact information, how people can get a hold of either website or phone number if they want to contact and maybe book an event through Travel One.
Sure. They can give me a call at 618-409-0143, or my email address is D for Dave, and then my last name, Kronk. So DKRONK@htc.net. And those are two ways that they can get a hold of me.
618, that's Southern Illinois, right? Where are you located?
I'm located in Waterloo, Illinois.
I'm from Belleville.
Oh, okay.
Dave, I wish you success on this, and I'm sure many listeners will enjoy this and maybe contact you. Maybe they've been afraid of trying to do an event like this on their own or just didn't think it was an option having a service animal, and apparently that's not the case.
No, it's not. And the other thing I want to let people know, Mike, is that most cruises that I book, for every person that books that goes on that group cruise with me, I make a donation to ACB. So not only are they having a great vacation, they're also supporting ACB.
There you go. You can't miss with that. You're also helping out the American Council for the Blind. That's why you're part of the ACB store here at booths number 3 and 4. Thanks
yes.
a lot, Dave. Check it out, folks, if you like. Live at ACB 2010, this is Michael Loft for Cerro Talk.
You've been listening to Cerro Talk. Visit us at www.cerrotalk.com. Send us an email at resources@cerrotalk.com or leave us a voicemail at 866-997-BLAB-2522. We may read your email or play your voicemail in the next podcast. Join us in 2 weeks as we explore all the internet and life has to offer. Until then, may you have an accessible digital life.